So it is my great pleasure and a sincere honor to welcome to the stage someone who I know is going to thrill you and entertain you with his tales about how the internet has changed emergencies. I need a very, very loud EMF welcome for Ben Proctor.
Thank you. Can you hear me? Oh, that's very exciting. Yes, thank you all for coming. And I don't just mean, oh, it's not working. I don't just mean to this event. I mean to Herefordshire, where I was born and bred, which means I've probably got the record for having traveled the least distance to come to EMF camp. So this is me. You know how it is. You submit a talk, and you think that's great. And then you think, just as the talk approaches, you think, how arrogant is it that I can explain to you how the internet has changed emergencies? And so this is my defense. So this is like my perspective. So I'm basically a general purpose data geek. I've been a volunteer for a weird internet thing that helps out in emergencies called the Standby Task Force for a long time. I used to be an emergency planner in public sector in the UK, and I also have a sideline training emergency planners in this stuff. So that's where I'm coming from on all this. You may or may not be familiar with the profession of emergency planners. Emergency planners are kind of born, not made. And there's a way to test whether you are born to be an emergency planner. So what I need you to do is just imagine you're walking down a street that you know very well, and suddenly there is a huge explosion in front of you. And in that moment of seeing that explosion, you make a decision. And we're not going to ask you what it is, but some people make a decision to run towards the explosion, and some people make a decision to run away from the explosion. And either of those people should not become emergency planners. If in that moment you think, we're going to need a lot of ambulances, where are they going to park? You should become an emergency planner. So very briefly, you've all come to a talk about how the internet has changed emergencies. We should probably explain what an emergency is. Because we're in the UK, we have the great honor of having the definition of emergency enshrined in law. Basically, it's what you would imagine an emergency to be. It's something that seriously threatens life or the environment or the security of the state. And I'm going to be randomly moving between kind of global international disasters and local UK emergencies in a way that doesn't necessarily make coherent sense, but I've got the microphone, and so you can't really stop me. There are three things I think it boils down to where the internet has really made a huge impact. And the first one is about maps. So I kind of wish that I'd just done my presentation about maps, because I have so much to say about how important and transformative mapping has been in humanitarian work that I'm going to run out of time. But the kind of story of maps for me, starts back in 2010, when a very large earthquake hit Haiti and devastated most of Port-au-Prince, the capital city. And it happened at a kind of crucial time for a number of things in the internet. So we had the internet, which was a good start. We also had a system called OpenStreetMap. Hands up if you are familiar with OpenStreetMap. Almost everybody, that's great. So that's a wiki for maps, which was started in 2004, and its original intention was to provide a license-free alternative to state mapping, which was usually locked up and expensive. But very quickly, people who got involved in that said, well, this could be really useful in like emergency response humanitarian work. So there had been a long drive to make use of it. But then there had been OpenStreetMap kind of deployments around humanitarian stuff before this point. What was really different here, I think, was this was very significantly reported in America. So for all sorts of reasons, this got a lot of attention in the US. And so you have now OpenStreetMap, which is kind of available and ready to be used for mapping in disaster zones, and then you have Americans who have a lot of data that could be useful from suddenly paying attention to what's going on in Haiti. So these people are search and rescue teams. After an earthquake, one of the first things that happens is search and rescue teams from around the world get on planes and they just fly into the area. And at this point, when they fly into Port-au-Prince, it's in Haiti, which is incredibly poorly mapped. The developed world is incredibly poorly mapped. So it's not necessarily that big a deal, because if there's a collapsed building, you can go and start digging in it. But how do you know whether you're digging in the right place? How do you coordinate with a load of other teams, all of whom are from outside of Haiti and don't know the names of the streets? So maps are a really crucial way to communicate. But like I say, Haiti, very poorly mapped. But because the Port-au-Prince earthquake... I've got a clicker, but it doesn't seem to be clicking. Sort of caught the attention of, I think, a lot of Americans. There was a sudden explosion around the world of people saying, let's get on to OpenStreetMap and let's start building a map on the fly so that people have some data there. And so you had these crisis camps, often in universities. They happened around the world. At the time, I think we were really proud that there may have been 1,000 people involved in this sort of mapping action, which seemed, like in 2010, that seemed like, wow, how many people, like now, the OpenStreetMap community can mobilize that sort of number just like that. And then what you got on the ground was, over the course of days, that's 10th of January, that's basically what appeared on OpenStreetMap, and Google Maps is very similar. And then by 12th of January, you started to get that more. And then by the 5th of February, you get like proper, hard, really, really high quality mapping. And there were some other things, like it's not just OpenStreetMap. There's a long-standing group called Map Action, who actually fly into disaster zones and start to generate maps for people. Like having the mapping data in the internet isn't sufficient. You need to get it into the hands of people on the ground. But really, from this point, I think the humanitarian world woke up to the fact that there was this amazing source of data, and they started to make a lot more use of it, demand a lot more. So this was Typhoon Haiyan, which was one of a couple of typhoons that threatened the Philippines in short order. And these are each of these squares is a change set, so it's basically an edit that's been made to the map. These were edits that were made in the days leading up to Haiyan hitting the Philippines. And by 2013, this had become kind of a normal response of the OpenStreetMap community, that where a hurricane or a disaster threatened, they would get online and they would start building a map so that they didn't have to do it after the fact. They could do it. It would be there available from that moment. But even then, that's of kind of limited value, because you're still doing it at the last minute. You're remote. You don't know what the names of the streets are from a satellite. You can see that there is a street, but you don't know what it's called. And so it's this, the community has now moved into this really excellent project. And if you've got any interest in this area, helping out with missing maps is like the best thing you could do. And essentially, it started with British Red Cross, American Red Cross, and Médecins Sans Frontières. And they've identified high-risk areas that are poorly mapped, and they're encouraging the community to get out there and map them early. But they partner with people on the ground, which is partly for practical reasons. So, like, people on the ground can go around and tell you what buildings are called, what the names of streets are. But also, there's a potential ethical problem with a load of people sitting in the West, with satellites paid for by the West, creating maps of other people's countries. And so the more we can do to kind of engage with people on the ground, the better. So Missing Maps is a great project. And now OpenStreetMap really is the best mapping for much of the world. So this is a city in Tanzania. I don't know anything about Tanzania. I just thought I'd pick a city. You'll see that Google Maps actually has, you know, a reasonable amount of data about that city, but there's a lot more granular data in OpenStreetMap. And that's pretty common wherever you go across the world. And this is roughly the same view in two different renders. So one of the beautiful things about OpenStreetMap is you get hold of the actual data, so you can create your own maps for your own purposes. So the bottom is the standard map, which you would just see on OpenStreetMap. The top right-hand corner is a humanitarian map, so it's designed for use in disaster response. So you'll see that there are different buildings show up, so pharmacies show up in the humanitarian map where they don't show up in the standard map. The colors are designed to use less printer ink when you print them out, and also to enable you to annotate on top of them. And search and rescue is kind of where it came from and is the most dramatic use of this. But I've heard people from Médecins Sans Frontières say OpenStreetMap has saved countless, genuinely countless lives for things like cholera control. Because when people come into a clinic and they have cholera, you need to find out where they're from. And if you haven't got a map, they'll say, I'm from that village over there. If someone else comes in and says they're from a different village, is that just a different name of the same village? Is it in the same place? Is it downstream? Without a map, tracing things like cholera outbreaks is incredibly difficult. With a map, it gets a lot easier. I put this in just to show that it's not just maps. Despite my enthusiasm for humanitarian OpenStreetMap team, I volunteer for a different group, and we essentially try and put data on top of the maps that OpenStreetMap have built. This was a project we ran with the World Bank in 2015 after TC PAM had hit Vanuatu. Vanuatu is a really remote set of Pacific islands, essentially, and tropical cyclone went through several of the islands and did an awful lot of damage. One of the things I did not know about international humanitarian response is the first people in and tends to be the fundraisers. So there isn't a big pot of international money sitting around for international, certainly for places like Vanuatu. So the first people in go in to do undertakings to assess the need for money so that they can go to global donors and ask for money to go and fix that. And so one of the things that commonly is done is a rapid damage assessment. So you go in and you work out which buildings are totally damaged, which buildings are partially damaged, so you get some idea of how many people are homeless and how much it's going to cost to rebuild. That's rapid damage assessment takes 6-8 weeks, typically. In Vanuatu, it takes a lot longer because it's a long time to get there. So as an experiment, the World Bank paid some drone pilots to go and overfly the area. And they took side-on images and they took top-down images. And the top-down images we gave to OpenStreetMap, and the side-on images we tagged. We got volunteers on the internet to tag every building. And so red tags are total damage, amber tags are partial damage, and blue tags are not significantly damaged. That was the most tedious. It was just in the terrible balance point between you had to have meticulous attention to detail, but it's incredibly repetitive. But it meant that we could do a rapid damage assessment in about a week, and most of that was getting drone pilots onto Vanuatu and then getting the data out so that we could see it, because Vanuatu is not well connected to the internet. There's been quite a lot of work to try and build machine learning into this sort of tool, and I've seen some experiments in the Houston floods, where I don't know if they were used by the agencies, but there's certainly people were using this sort of approach, but with machine learning applied to it, to do rapid damage assessment. So maps. Maps are a big positive that the internet has had. The second really big impact, I think, is citizen self-organizing. So UNHCR, quite a lot, so United Nations High Commission for Refugees. They do quite a lot of work trying to understand the needs of refugees and internally displaced people. One of the things they say is that amongst the most asked questions when people present at refugee camps and IDP camps is, do you have Wi-Fi? And is there someone to charge my mobile phone? And where do I get a SIM card? And those are typically asked before, do you have food and water? So the degree to which being connected is kind of now fundamental to human being, not kind of just it's great, you know, I don't need to tell you, we have Ethernet to our tents, but the degree to which connections are kind of fundamental to the way people think about the world. And if you imagine, the reason that you want this is you need to find out whether your family is safe, you need to tell them that you are safe, you need to talk to your friend, like you, that everybody that you know is on the internet. And so this has had a couple of kind of significant consequences. So one is that almost without noticing it, communications infrastructure has become a critical part of emergencies, disaster recovery, and a lot of it was never designed for that. So the cell network is a good example. Like the cell network was designed originally to, I'm looking at someone who knows a lot about this, so I'm hoping that he's nodding. The cell network certainly in the West was designed to be like an add-on to the critical infrastructure, which was the fixed line network. Well, actually, the cell network is a piece of critical infrastructure. And you've seen that, you've started to see that shift happen, and certainly in kind of, to switch back to UK emergency planning, when I became an emergency planner in 2005, the 999 service going down was the thing that we had, that was the communications risk we had in our plans. Now, the mobile service going down, the internet going down, those are much more, those have appeared in our risk registers in a way that we never thought of them before. And then critically, because human beings are incredibly connected and they have these tools and techniques that enable them to talk to their friends and family, it turns out they use them to self-organize. So I've got a couple of examples. So this is 2013 in Aberystwyth, which is in Midwest Wales. They had a huge and not really expected flooding event. And it affected not just Aberystwyth, it affected some villages upstream, and it really was quite kind of dramatic. Thankfully, I don't think it caused any deaths directly, but it made an awful lot of people homeless straight away. And without really the official authorities being aware, the people of Aberystwyth started to decide that they were going to sort stuff out. They were going to offer, like you see this a lot, people offer temporary accommodation to each other. They offer Wi-Fi, they offer power. What's kind of worrying from the kind of state responder point of view is how much faith can we have in these people? Like, how safe are you going to the house as a friend of a friend of a friend on Facebook? Would you not be better going to the leisure center and keeping on a camp bed, which is the thing we have in the plan for you? And that's actually no longer a relevant question, because it turns out this is just what happened. Like, this is so the question has shifted from 2013, where Ceredigion Council were going, is this right? Is this safe? We need to give people sensible advice, because this is the way that people respond to emergencies. And I find it quite sort of kind of life-affirming. Like, almost always in emergencies, disasters, human beings in large numbers go and help each other out. And they, when they do it on the internet, you can see it, but they do it anyway. This is perhaps a slightly more significant thing. So in the Nepal earthquake, there was a fantastic organization called Kathmandu Living Labs. They were part of the OpenStreetMap community, so they were mapping Nepal locally as on OpenStreetMap, because they could see that it would be useful. And because they were there and doing that, when the earthquake struck, they suddenly kind of turned into this hub for community action. And they use this tool, which is used a lot, even though it's horrible, called Ushahidi. So Ushahidi was originally developed for election monitoring, or post-election violence monitoring. And actually, I don't think it's got a great UI, but lots of people know how to use it. It's free, and what it enables you to do is take public reports on a map. So one that we worked on in Nepal, there was an orphanage full of 50 children, and they're not there anymore. Does anyone know where they are? Is a thing that you can put on the map. And then you can track comments and workflow against that report, and then someone can close it down. So say that that's been resolved. And Kathmandu Living Labs set up an Ushahidi instance. This was towards the kind of end of that deployment. So where it says 1,015, that's 1,015 reports of something that needs attention. And then with almost all of those, there was a response and triaging. And this is all happening at a kind of citizen-to-citizen level. The state and, to a large extent, the kind of the humanitarian responders who go into disaster zones weren't really engaging with that. So part of what my volunteer group do is to try and help humanitarian responders understand that this is a significant thing. But again, I think this is because Aberystwyth is in the West and it's nice and rich, and it's not totally surprising that people go onto Facebook and they try and help each other out. Nepal is not rich, and yet they use this kind of these free but kind of cutting edge bits of technology to self-organize kind of significant humanitarian response. And then within the world of disaster response, there's a whole kind of set of layers of citizens who are just getting on with it to different degrees. So my group, Standby Task Force, is just a group of people. Essentially, we're emergency on-call librarians. Like, we're people who like searching the internet for things and putting it on maps. But there's a whole kind of swathe of them, and they have kind of sprung up out of people like yourselves, who have skills and are motivated to do something about it. Rather like the Kathmandu Living Labs problem, the kind of the people who expect to be doing something about it don't really know what to do with these weirdos who appear on the internet and start. And so the UN has set up a thing called the DHN, the Digital Humanitarian Network, to try and provide an interface between the weird, we call them VTCs, volunteer technical communities, but these kind of weird, amorphous, citizen-led, self-starting technical groups who actually have high levels of capability but don't know anything about humanitarian response, and the people who are on the ground trying to kind of install clean water and all that stuff. And so if you're inspired to do any of this stuff, find yourself a DHN group and join it. We've seen this citizen self-organizing happening this year in the Kerala floods. So lots and lots of people now. What's interesting, kind of vaguely academically to me, is globally the kind of way this is done is moved off platforms like Facebook and Twitter and other more public platforms onto things like WhatsApp. So the Kerala floods, huge amounts of citizen self-organizing, but not really done on the public web, all done on interlocking WhatsApp groups. And that's interesting. It's not because people have made a decision that they want to use WhatsApp above these other platforms. It's just they're on WhatsApp, their friends are on WhatsApp, that's what you do. I think I'm running out of time, so we also now, I need to explain very briefly, even though I'm running out of time. So you know how it is, you have a set of slides that you've used a few times. This is the slide that I always use to talk about convergent volunteers. So this is the 2014 floods in Somerset, but it's a picture of the Prime Minister of the time visiting, and I just couldn't put a picture of David Cameron up. I just couldn't do it, so I had to replace him with a penguin. What we have in the UK and around the world is this idea of convergent volunteers. So not just people getting online, people organizing online and then going to places. And this is such an issue, it's of such significance that there's now UK government guidance to all the local public sector bodies about how you should think about convergent volunteers. So the Somerset floods, thousands, possibly tens of thousands of people turned up in Somerset, which is great, but it's not clear that they were necessarily very helpful. But that's not necessarily, that might be because they were not directed to helpful things to do. Who's watching my time? I've got loads, all right. And then the third bit is, which I've kind of alluded to, is formal organizations of people who expect to be doing this stuff. I find there's a lot of friction as the internet changes the way that they think stuff. So dramatic one that UK citizens may remember is 2011. We had riots in cities in England. There were lots of causes for the riots, but one of the things that was very significant was people used messaging platforms and social media platforms to organize, coordinate, to work out where the police were so they could go into other places. And the police did not expect that at all. They were not geared up for that. Even though it wasn't the first time it happened, they still hadn't noticed. And you're now, like, policing his attitude to online social networking has completely transformed in the UK since then. So neighborhood policing is really emphasizes getting out into virtual communities because they don't want to be in the stage where people, citizens are kind of organizing to riot and the police have no idea of what's going on. And a significant phenomenon that I guess has always been there with emergencies, but the internet puts it on some sort of drug that accelerates things a lot. Speed and is rumors. So people, it's a weird phenomenon, but in emergencies, people kind of seed the internet with rumors, false rumors. And not usually, not with any, don't seem to have any sort of political agenda. That's just a thing that people do. And often these rumors don't go anywhere, but sometimes the rumor will capture kind of a sense of where people are, and then it gets spread very widely, and it seems to cause a lot of unsettling. And this is, again, another example of the riots. So when the riots spread to the center of Birmingham, someone tweeted a picture of this, which is, if you know the center of Birmingham, it's a huge metal bull outside the bull ring, which has had its head taken off by the rioters. And this was incredibly widely shared and caused, I think, people to be very worried because it just sort of encapsulated this idea that the police had lost control of the streets. And yet, A, how would they get the head off a bronze statue? And B, it was, you could see from, if you knew anything about Birmingham, you could see from the shops behind that this was an old photo that had been photoshopped. And one of the interesting things is that the community in Birmingham, the online community in Birmingham, scotched that rumor very quickly, but the rumor kept coming back on an 8-hour cycle. Because people who were not online when the rumor was originally scotched logged on, saw the image, went, oh my God. And that that is a thing that, certainly in the UK, we still, agencies don't know what to do about that. Do they leave it because the community will sort it out? Should they say it's not true? 5 minutes. Okay, that's great. That's totally on plan. There isn't half my presentation yet to go. And just on the edge there, I'm really just sharing my pain. So I used to work for Herefordshire Council as a comms officer. A few years ago, someone returned from Sierra Leone, felt a bit ill, went into a GP walk-in clinic in the center of Hereford, and said, I've just come back from the Ebola area and I'm feeling ill, and which he shouldn't have done. So that person shouldn't have done that. They should have phoned up and said, I'm feeling a bit ill. But then the walk-in clinic didn't do what they should have done, which is say, go home and phone us. They evacuated the walk-in clinic and put up a sign saying, it's just, and left this potential patient in there and put up a sign saying, suspected Ebola case. So it became quite a significant rumor. And the frustration for me was the public health people who knew what they were talking about were absolutely clear right from the start that there was very little chance that this was really Ebola, but they wouldn't say it because they have to go through a set of protocols, which is fine unless you live in Hereford when there's a sign outside the GP surgery going, Ebola has come to the... and so this friction of the people who are supposed to look after you in emergencies interacting with what's really happening in emergencies is a kind of ongoing... problem. This, I will tell you very quickly. So one other thing we haven't really come to terms with is bad actors in these networks. So this was in 2011. You may or may not remember that there was a NATO bombing campaign in Libya. My volunteer group worked for the UN privately to map what was going on and provide that information to the UN so that they could plan a humanitarian response afterwards. It became clear very quickly that people sympathetic to the Gaddafi regime had infiltrated our network because we never gave any thought to operational security, and in fact, we still don't really know how to handle operational security, and they were trying to manipulate the information that was on there, and that was back in 2011, and that was before we knew about what Russia were up to, and the, we don't know how to deal with bad actors trying to influence our normal discourse. We really don't know how to deal with it in an emergency or a disaster. It's an issue. That's an example there. So, how the internet has changed emergencies. Maps are better, and maps save lives. Maps are the thing. It's made communications infrastructure critical. It's enabled citizens to do things they never could before. But we're experiencing this friction with kind of established organizations and their normal way of working. And what could you do about it? If this has inspired you, if you ever, ever, ever do anything with geodata, do it with OSM. The more people work with OSM, the better OSM gets for the world. And a lot of the missing map stuff is relies on a thing that was developed in the UK for a completely different purpose. It's called the Walking Papers. And so if we develop things here, they can have unforeseen benefits around the world. If you have tech skills and you want to help out, join a DHN partner organization. And if you can work out how to fix Twitter and Facebook, that would be great. That's all I have. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ben. That was an absolutely amazing talk. We have time for a few questions. Just stick your hand up if you do have questions, just so I can get a sense of how many we've got. Okay, great.
Hey, thank you very much for the talk. Really interesting stuff. There's been a couple of application built for Android and iOS to kind of supplement Google Maps for things like traffic and speed cameras and police, you know, all that fun stuff. Have you thought about maybe making applications sort of like this for emergencies? Because then it would bring it down to sort of very low level that anybody could start using it and kind of feed into the system just by taking out your smartphone that you know used to use. Is there something like that out there? Have you thought about this?
I think that sounds like a great idea. What has worked so far is where people build applications for their own purposes, but then open source them. So like Ushahidi is a critical kind of tool for citizen self-organizing, but it wasn't built for that purpose. And so the Map of Mercia OpenStreetMap group is building exactly what you described. They're building kind of traffic data into OpenStreetMap in Birmingham. And I think we should focus on building applications that have a use now and let people who need them get hold of them when they need them, rather than trying to guess what application might be useful in the future, if that makes sense.
What about emergencies
like disasters? So I guess.
Yeah, what about emergencies like disasters? And
so I guess my experience is in a disaster, people reach for the tools that they are familiar with and some tools that other people are familiar with. People do try and build disaster-specific applications, but they often don't gain traction because in a disaster, you want the thing that you know how to use, not the thing that was designed for this purpose. So I think we should build cool stuff, but not build it for emergencies. Build it for use and make it available to people in emergencies.
Thank
you. Sorry, not so much of a question, but just a call out to Missing Maps, that we hold mapathons regularly. Go to missingmaps.org and there'll be a mapathon in your area, or there's lots of them. I organise Reading Missing Maps and I'm involved with London Missing Maps as well. So
maybe Missing Maps could have a village at the next EMF.
Wonderful idea. Any more questions? There's one over here.
Hello, it's just interesting hearing about Aberystwyth since me and my friend were staying there at the time. But my question is, you mentioned these large organizations which have like bureaucracy in place or process in place, which means they can't comment on like an Ebola thing. And then the small, you know, people to people, like peer networks. Is there anything between them two kind of extremes or like a bridge of, you know, maybe knowledgeable people that could comment on the Ebola thing because they're not as constrained by process?
Yeah, and in fact, the police have cottoned onto that since the riots. So in Herefordshire, in South Hereford, we had a couple of years ago a set of stabbings in close proximity, which the police said were not related to. It was just a chance thing. But the police now are smart enough to know that a statement from the superintendent won't go anywhere, but the neighborhood policing team putting something out on Twitter will get a lot of trust because everybody knows them already in that environment. And so it isn't that, so that's the message for, I think, for formal organizations is you need to join the network. Like the world is not as you think it is. You need to join the network. And then we need public health professionals in the network that people know and trust. That's
fantastic. A huge round of applause for Ben.